be that type.
During the entire ride, the driver kept asking stupid questions. How old are you? What do you think of Korea? Can you eat kimchi? And he snorted every time I answered, as if to mock my Korean pronunciation. The taxi meter steadily ticked higher and higher. So did my anger meter. The taxi pulled up in front of the hotel. I checked the price on the meter and held out some bills. The driver took the bills from me and flipped the meter lever up. The display on the meter turned to zero. For several moments, I waited. The driver continued to look out the front windshield as if I didn't exist. The taxis pulling into the driveway behind us began honking their horns. The hotel doorman was coming closer to investigate. I had no choice but to say something. "Give me my change," I said in Korean. The driver turned slightly toward me and made this thoroughly repulsive face that seemed to say, "Huh?" And my anger meter shot straight to 100. I drilled the guy in the back of the head with a right corkscrew punch, yelling, "Die!" in Japanese. The driver's body pitched forward, his face smashing against the steering wheel with a dull whack. "Take that, you bastard!" When he turned around, his face was crimson. The driver began to rant and rave in a deafeningly loud Korean I couldn't understand. That's the problem with Koreans. They're so short-tempered. The driver opened his door and got out. I got out and quickly readied myself for a rumble. The driver came at me with short, quick steps, his right fist cocked next to his face. He lunged toward me with his entire body, so I sidestepped to the left. His punch whiffed the air, leaving his outstretched body completely open. I landed a right hook to his liver. The driver let out a groan and crumpled to the ground. Before I could bask in victory, the doorman snuck up on me from behind and got me in a full Nelson. Just as I was going to break free, I heard a familiar voice at my back. "What's going on?" It was my old man. I tried desperately to get free so I could explain the situation, but I couldn't. My father asked the doorman with the vice-like hold what happened. The doorman jabbered in Korean so fast that I couldn't make out any of what he said. The doorman didn't know what had gone on inside the taxi. My father's face went dark in an instant. His eyes shifted to the driver on the ground and then back to me. He seethed with murderous intent. This was bad. Figuring my first priority was to break out of this Nelson hold the doorman had me in, I struggled with all my might. In that instant, the same person that taught me how to throw a liver hook landed a real good one with all his weight behind it. The first thing I threw up was the grilled karbi ribs. The doorman released my arms and let me fall to the ground. As I was throwing up the bibimbap from dinner, my mother's voice floated above me. "Is something the matter?" "He tried to get this taxi driver's money and hit him," I heard my father explain. I managed to wobble to my feet so I could explain what really happened. A huge crowd had gathered around us. Taxi drivers, hotel staff, and patrons were all holding their breath, staring at the shitstorm that had come down on me. And then it got worse.
"You ungrateful boy!"
Along with this rebuke, my mother's palm came flying at me. It connected with my chin at just the right angle to make my neck twist completely sideways, causing me to lose my equilibrium and fall down again, right onto the bibimbap that I'd just thrown up. As if that wasn't enough, I was pelted by the thunderous applause that rained down on me. Somehow, I managed to raise my head. The crowd clapped with big, sweeping arm motions like a concert audience after a maestro's performance. The taxi driver was sobbing for joy on my father's chest. Seeing this, the crowd became weepy-eyed. Some were shaking my mother's hand. The applause continued. Now and then I felt a stab of pain from the hostile stares of the crowd. Korea was a Confucian country. And then I thought, I hate all you grown-ups, and Korea can go to hell. While I was telling the story, some of the restaurant staff had trickled into the private room with bento boxes to take a late dinner break. And when my mother came in with tea for everyone, just as I finished telling the story, the staff put down their chopsticks and clapped. Not knowing why, my mother blinked with a blank look on her face. When the clapping subsided, Naomi-san said quietly, It's such a good story, no matter how many times I hear it.
Really?
Soon after my mother set the tea down and left the room, a guy asked, "Do you have any new stories for us?" The restaurant workers were young, all around the same age, but they were ethnically diverse. There was a Zainichi North Korean, Zainichi South Korean, Chinese, Taiwanese, and Japanese. I don't know what got into me, but I decided to talk about mitochondrial DNA. Okay, this story is a little different from the last one. Stay awake if you can. Mitochondrial DNA is the DNA found in a special part of cells, the mitochondria. It's different from the rest of your DNA. Because mitochondrial DNA mutates at a high rate, leaving behind markers where the mutation has occurred, mitochondrial DNA analysis is a really important way scientists search for the origins of humankind. Silence. The Japanese girl's hand went up. You lost me when you started talking about mutations. Basically, we all have unique markers passed down from our ancestors, and they'll likely continue to be passed down intact to our descendants. So if you use these markers to trace your roots, you can have one big family gathering.
What do you mean?
Asked the Zainichi South Korean man. Well, you know that we were born at the very end of one of countless branches of the family tree. Our great-great-grandfathers and great-great-grandmothers gave birth to our great-grandfathers, and our great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers gave birth to our grandfathers, and our grandfathers and grandmothers gave birth to our fathers, and then our fathers and mothers got busy, and we were born. If you're really bored, you can go all the way back to your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. Anyway, our bodies are encoded with a tremendous variety of genetic data inherited from our ancestors, and the Chinese girl took it from there. If we use these unique markers from mitochondrial DNA, we can trace our roots, right? I nodded. I forgot to tell you before that, when mitochondrial DNA is passed on to a child, only the mother's is inherited. In other words, you only need to trace a simple line from mother to grandmother to great-grandmother without having to check the paternal side. So it's easy. Until you finally trace your roots all the way back to a single woman.
You're right. This story is different from the other one, said Naomi-san.
The reality is the descendants of this single woman were scattered all over the world, and it could get really interesting if we were to all gather in one place. Like, maybe you'd turn out to have the same mitochondrial DNA as the President of the United States. The Zainichi North Korean man said,
I have the same mitochondrial DNA as Brad Pitt. I'm sure of it.
Loud boos from the others. I waited for the boos to die down. They did this study using mitochondrial DNA and found out that about half of the Japanese living on the main island of Honshu have the mitochondrial DNA that's common in Koreans and Chinese. Only 5% have the mitochondrial DNA found in Japanese. About 2,000 years ago, a whole lot of these people, the Yayoi, came to Japan from the continent. And before the Japanese knew what was happening, they'd become minorities on the Honshu main island. But a Japanese person who has the mitochondrial DNA of Koreans and Chinese is still Japanese, the Japanese girl said.
Sure, because they were born in Japan, raised in Japan, and have Japanese citizenship.
But that's all it is. Just like how if you were born in America, raised in America and had American citizenship, you'd be an American. Our roots aren't bound by citizenship, said Jung-il.
So how far back do you have to trace your roots? The Japanese girl asked. I mean, we don't have a family tree lying around at home or anything.
Jung-il said, maybe just skip over the stuff in the middle and go straight to the single woman. Back when the single woman was alive, there were no distinctions like nationality or citizenship. Maybe we should think of ourselves as just descendants of that time. Everyone was deep in their own thoughts.
Nationality isn't much more than a lease to an apartment, I said. If you don't like the apartment anymore, you break the lease and get out.
Can you really do that? The Japanese girl asked.
It's written clearly in the Constitution of Japan, Article 22, Paragraph 2. Freedom of all persons to move to a foreign country and to divest themselves of their nationality shall be inviolate. It's my favorite article in the Constitution.
But, began the Zainichi North Korean man, even if we know all that stuff, isn't it pointless if the people discriminating against you don't?
What matters is that we know, I said. Those ignorant haters who discriminate based on nationality and ethnicity are pathetic. We need to educate ourselves and make ourselves stronger and forgive them.
Not that I'm anywhere near that yet.
We all laughed. My mother came into the room and announced, "Time to go back to work." We all promised to meet again soon, and the staff workers excused themselves. It was getting late, so Jong-il and I decided to call it a night. Waiting for the elevator, we thanked Naomi-san for treating us to dinner, and she said, "Come back and tell us some more stories." She smiled and gently caressed my cheek.
Thank God I'd studied that stuff.
Knowledge is power, as they say. The moment the elevator door closed, I took a pretty serious punch in the ribs from the pervy bastard next to me. Although it was already pretty late when I got home, I decided to stick to my daily routine. I changed into my training clothes and went for a run. I ran 6 miles, shadow boxed for 10 3-minute rounds with a minute interval in between, and finished with 50 push-ups and 50 sit-ups. After doing some stretches to cool down, I took a shower. I admired the reflection of my abs in the mirror until I realized I was acting like a total narcissist. I went back to my room and began practicing the guitar. I'd learned how to get all the fingers down to play the F chord recently. To finish off the 90-minute practice, I listened to a CD of Jimi Hendrix playing the Star-Spangled Banner at Woodstock. To protest the Vietnam War, where it seemed like only black and brown people were being sent to the front lines and dying, Hendrix played America's national anthem on his guitar like this.
Scree, 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 wah, wah, growl, growl. Scree, 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 ga, 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 ga.
It was an awesome sound, no matter how many times I heard it. The voices of minority people had no way of reaching the top, so they had to find some way of making their voices louder. Someday, I might want to play the national anthem of this country and shred like Hendrix did. I was practicing the guitar for precisely that moment. I sat down at my desk. After flipping through the Green Beret combat manual, I closed my eyes and simulated a combat situation in my head. 3 enemies down. I was pretty sleepy by then, but I decided to run through my nightly studies. I'd been reading up on the mono-ethnic myth that's been tossed around in Japan for ages. The lessons were delightful. I learned about how scholars and politicians from back when the word DNA hadn't even existed spouted off colorful lies to discriminate against other ethnic groups. I read through the materials I'd gathered from the library, trying to understand how this mono-ethnic myth worked. Just the vocabulary and euphemisms made my head hurt. Monolithic. Discrimination. Assimilation. Expulsion. Pure blood. Mixed blood. Foreign. Homogeneity. Crossbreed. Yamato people. Barbarians. Bloodline. Emishi. Kumaso, Ryukyu, national polity, nationality, exclusionism, purity, emperor-centered historiography, Japanese expansionism, unbroken imperial line, Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, national prosperity and defense, universal brotherhood, Japan and Korea as one,
Japan-Korea single ancestry. Japan-Korea annexation. Japanization. Subjects. Governor general. Soshi kaime. Territorial possession. Empire. Colonization. Unification. Invasion. Subjugation. Puppet. Submission. Oppression. Control. Subordination. Isolation. Segregation. Miscegenation. Mixed residence. Mixing. Indigenous. Going to America. Difference. Prejudice. Diversity. Propagation. Reproduction. Alien race. Inferior race. Superior race. Blood relative. Expansion. Territory. Rule. Exploitation. Plunder. Patriotism. Eugenics. Compatriot. Class. Heterogeneous. Union. Unity, collusion, anti-foreign, exclusion, removal, massacre, extermination. Screw it. I decided to become Norwegian. I'd need money. I was banging around the room trying to dig up anything worth selling when my father opened the door. What time do you think it is? Knock. Don't be a jerk. He sat down on the bed. I ignored him and went about my task. What are you doing? He asked. Getting out of Japan. Going to Norway. What's got into you all of a sudden? I'm going to Norway and become Norwegian. I'll learn to speak Norwegian and forget this ugly Japanese language. I'm done with this place. And I'm going to... Calm down. I'm going to marry a cute Norwegian girl and have a cute biracial daughter and build a happy family. So you've given it some thought. But why Norway? I'm getting as far away from Japan as I can. The other side from Japan is South America. I hate the heat. You have given it some thought. My father reached for the pile of books I'd stacked on the floor and picked up Thus Spoke Zarathustra off the top. What do you know about Nietzsche? He asked. I know some. I heard he was a little funny in the head. Did you know that? Better that than a womanizer with a saint complex. Suddenly, I felt the old man's menace in the air. Don't talk bad about Marx, he said. He's a good guy. I didn't want to get hit, so I decided not to talk back. He watched me work. The menace was gone, creeped out by the silence. I stopped what I was doing and looked at my father. He had a serious look on his face. Our eyes met. No soy coreano, ni japonés. Soy un nomada desarraigado, he muttered. Huh? It's Spanish. I always wanted to be a Spaniard. I didn't reply. But it didn't work out. Turns out, it wasn't about speaking the language. Language has everything to do with your identity, in theory, maybe, he said, cutting me off. But we live in circumstances that can't always be explained away by logic. You'll understand someday. I sat down at my desk. The old man got up from the bed and came closer. After looking through some of the papers spread out on the desk, he said, Not a bad thing to know something about darkness. You can't talk about light without some knowledge of darkness. Like your buddy Nietzsche said, he who fights with monsters should look to it that he himself does not become a monster. And if you gaze long into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you. Keep that in mind. He stared in the direction of the window behind me as he spoke. I turned around, expecting to find a crib sheet taped to the window. But there was nothing there. Only the dead of night. When I turned back around, my father delivered a punch that glanced off my cheek as if to caress it. You've been acting testy lately. I'm not saying you need to get into trouble like you used to, but you should go out more. Like your buddy Nietzsche said, any man in his youth should apply himself to amusement to his heart's content. Too long a time in a forest of words will leave him trapped and unable to escape. You made that up. My father let out a chuckle and tossed the papers back on the desk. Go to sleep. As he moved off, I asked, What did you say in Spanish before?
My father picked up the pen on the desk and wrote something down.
Look it up yourself.
Just as my father got to the door, I asked, "Why did you want to be Spanish?" He turned around and answered with a straight face,
"I heard there were lots of beautiful women in Spain."
On his way out the door, he began to sing the Beach Boys' Hawaii.
Jackass.
I gathered the books and papers off the desk and set them down on the floor. I decided to keep them there for now. Then I decided to think about Sakurai until I fell asleep. 4. I called Sakurai for the first time on Friday night, exactly a week after the night we met. As soon as she answered, she said, "Working women in America have something like a manual for how not to get played by men, and one hard and fast rule is to always turn down a date offer that comes later in the week."
I hadn't even asked her out yet. I was meaning to, of course.
Why's that?
Because men are busy asking out their top choice earlier in the week. When they strike out, they go, "Hey, she'll do," and call the fallback girl later in the week. Women have to say no when that happens, or they'll be seen as convenient. See?
I didn't reply.
Not that I mind, because I hate rules like that.
Of course she minds. I'm sure of it.
Next time, I'll be more careful.
Don't forget.
I knew it.
Our date was set for Sunday. Sunday. I arrived at our meeting place at the east exit of Shinjuku Station exactly at 1. Sakurai was nowhere in sight. I stood off to the side of the ticket entrance and waited. 10 minutes passed. Anticipating a long wait, I bought a Newsweek at the kiosk and began to read. As I became absorbed in an interesting article about a former commando in the North Korean Special Operation Force who was a personal bodyguard to King Sihanouk of Cambodia, something slammed softly into me. The collision had a familiar sensation. I looked up, and there was Sakurai's unguarded smile.
"Sorry I'm late."
"This hardly counts as late."
Her smile grew wider, and she asked,
"So, what do you want to do?"
I realized after I'd hung up the phone the other night that we'd only agreed to meet and hadn't discussed what we were going to do. All we wanted to do was to see each other. Before I could suggest seeing a movie, Sakurai spoke first.
"I don't want to walk around Shibuya, which is always packed like a train, or get matching tattoos on our arms to commemorate our first date, or go to a bad Italian restaurant whose only claim to fame is that it's always crowded, or sing karaoke inside a tiny doghouse of a box. Definitely not."
I hastily shook my head.
"I wasn't thinking any of those things. Although I was thinking about going to a movie or something."
"Is there a particular movie you'd like to see?"
"Not especially."
"Then let's do something else."
"Okay.
What?" "Do you want to come with me?"
she asked, as though it were a challenge.
I nodded.
"Then let's go,"
Sakurai said, and pointed to the ticket machines. We started walking in that direction. I rolled the Newsweek into a cylinder and held it in one hand. Sakurai said cheerfully,
"Looks like a club. Are you going to protect me?"
I tossed the magazine at the trash bin some distance away. It went in.
"I don't need a club to do that."
Seemingly happy, Sakurai body-checked me with all her might. I staggered from the impact. Sakurai looked at me, her brows furrowed.
"Maybe we'll need that club back."
Sakurai and I took the train halfway around the Yamanote Line loop and got off at Yurakucho. After exiting the station, Sakurai headed toward Hibiya. Dressed in a purple jacket and white skinny jeans with a pair of beige hiking boots, she breezed down the office-lined street. Wearing a black jacket, white t-shirt, regular jeans, and loafers, I silently trailed after her. We wound up at a corporation-run art museum on the top floor of a building near Hibiya Moat. Sakurai entered the building as if she'd been there many times and boarded the elevator. I had never been to an art museum before, but I liked looking at art books. Jong-il lent them to me.
"Do you come here a lot?"
I asked as soon as we got on the elevator. She shook her head. My first time. I've always wanted to come here, but felt weird going in alone. Are you having second thoughts?
I shook my head.
When the elevator opened at our floor, Sakurai walked straight up to the ticket booth and bought her own ticket, before I had a chance to pay. Featured in the exhibit were painters who'd made their name in the French art world. There were some pretty impressive names. Rouault, Braque, Chagall, Picasso, Dali. See anyone you like? Asked Sakurai upon entering the exhibit. Rouault and Chagall. Who are they? She smiled playfully. I don't know the first thing about art. The way Sakurai and I looked at art was a contrast in styles. I stopped and studied each and every painting. Sakurai, seemingly knowing her likes and dislikes at first glance, stood rapt in front of paintings she liked and blew right past the ones she didn't. It was all so clear-cut and refreshing. I decided to do the same. I stopped only at Rouault's The Old King and Chagall's The Poet Reclining. Working on my way through the exhibit in this way, I gradually closed the distance between me and Sakurai, who'd been quite a bit ahead of me. She was standing before a Dali painting, smiling. The name of the work she was admiring was The Atavism of Dusk, a reimagination of Millet's Angelus. It might have been called a reimagination, but to my eyes, it was just a hideous parody. The couple giving prayer to the dusk. The man had a skull for a head, and the woman had something like a spear sticking out of her body. And the country landscape had been turned into desolate rocks. Isn't it great? Sakurai asked as she turned to me. I gave her a vague nod. She frowned, dissatisfied by my reaction. She spent a lot of time in front of the Dali paintings. At times, she giggled as she leaned so far over the barrier that her nose nearly touched the paint. Other times, she let out a sigh. I stared at Sakurai the whole time. Watching her never grew old. Sakurai stopped before the last of the Dali paintings and said, "It's like the artist is picking a fight with me, provoking me, like, you think you understand this painting?" This last painting was of a human body made of a series of drawers. Some were opened, some closed. I don't understand it at all, but what I do know is that the artist is trying to push my buttons, and my heart is pounding. See? Saying this, Sakurai grabbed my hand, pulled it closer, and pressed my palm to her chest. She wasn't kidding. Her heart was racing. Then she put her palm against the middle of my chest. Yours is pounding too, Sugihara. Her heart beat even faster. Mine was beating even faster, but that was because people were beginning to gather around us and stare. Sakurai and I pulled back our hands almost simultaneously and retreated from the Dali painting. She was chuckling happily. I was so embarrassed that in an attempt to distract her, I said, "I read in the papers the other day that Dali is really popular with elementary school boys now." She said, "Oh yeah?" and was smiling until suddenly she wasn't. She punched me lightly in the ribs. "Excuse me for having the artistic taste of a schoolboy." I bought two programs at the booth near the exit and handed one to Sakurai. She thanked me and took the program. "That was fun," she said. I nodded earnestly. We went to Hibiya Park, and after walking around for a while, sat down on a bench and let time pass idly by. It was a pleasant spring evening. "Can I ask you something?" asked Sakurai.
"Sure."
"What's your family like?"
"There's three of us, my parents and me." "What about you?"
"We're four, my parents and an older sister." "Where is your rural hometown?"
"I don't have one. You?"
"My father's family home is in Kansai, and my mother's is in Kyushu." "What does your father do?"
"He's just a humble, independent businessman. What about your father?"
"Just a humble salaryman." "How many girls have you gone out with?"
One.
When was that?
My second year of junior high school, for a month.
Ooh, that's short. Why did you break up?
You don't have to answer if you don't want. I don't mind. I blew off a date and poof, that was it.
Why did you blow it off?
A buddy asked me to go on a trip. It was at the same time as my date, and I chose to go with my buddy.
Whatever, she said in disgust. Why would you do something like that?
That's just the way guys are in junior high, I said lamely. You have to choose your buddies over your girlfriend. Any guy who chooses his girlfriend over his friends will get himself branded as a traitor. He'll be persecuted.
That's so stupid.
You're right.
Where did you go, anyway?
Nagoya.
What for?
Sightseeing.
That's weird.
My friend and I rode the local train to Nagoya, having sworn to each other that we would conquer the parlors of Nagoya and return to Tokyo as pachinko kings. The trip was a blast. With our winnings, we stayed at a hotel, ate some fantastic miso udon noodles, and sat in the first-class car on the bullet train back to Tokyo. We went on a school day, of course. My father decked me when I got home.
Your girlfriend must have been angry, said Sakurai.
After she ignored me for 2 weeks, she called me a loser.
Sakurai said, well, of course,
and punched me in the shoulder. The conversation stalled. As I searched for something to talk about, Sakurai suddenly began to talk.
I've been out with 3 boys. The first was when I was in 5th grade, a boy in the same class with round eyes. He looked a little like Tom Cruise. I broke up with him because he didn't give me anything for White Day. I was young then. The next one was in my 2nd year of junior high school. It was a boy a year above me. He was captain of the swim team and class president. We broke up after he invited me to his house one Sunday and, with a straight face, handed me a red racing swimsuit and asked me to put it on. I slapped him really hard and stormed out of there. Thinking back on it now, I guess I could have worn the swimsuit for him. He'd probably become a little unbalanced from the pressure of being captain of the swim team and class president at the same time. He was such a serious student. He had a tiny bald spot behind one ear, from the stress, I guess. The 3rd boy was when I was in the 1st year of high school. He was a college student at Keio University, the son of a lawyer. A really horrible guy, really stupid. He'd say stuff like, the people around me are such imbeciles.
Why did you go out with a guy like that? I said, asking the obvious.
I had a weakness for confident men back then, she said plainly. Every girl goes through a phase at least once when she's vulnerable to confident men.
Oh.
I broke up with him after 2 weeks, she continued, because a foreigner stopped us on the street in Roppongi and tried to speak to us in English.
What do you mean?
The man was probably asking for directions. Anyway, he comes up to us and says, "Excuse me," in English. My boyfriend is all smiles and confident up until, excuse me, but soon all these difficult words come flying out of the man's mouth, and my boyfriend's eyes start jumping everywhere. I half expected smoke to come out of his ears. He noticed me staring at him and somehow managed to regain his confidence and said to the foreign man, what do you think he said to him?
I can't imagine, I said.
He said, aha!
Real confident.
Aha! Like that. That's when I realized this guy was an idiot.
She was giggling saying this, but I couldn't bring myself to laugh. I prayed never to be spoken to by a foreigner while I was with Sakurai.
All he needed to say was, I can't speak English, she added, still smiling.
I made a mental note. A hint of mischief came into Sakurai's eyes.
Don't you want to ask how far I went with these boys?
After some wavering, I shook my head. Knowing will only upset me. A tender smile came over her face. She said, "Don't be stupid," and punched me hard in the shoulder.
As I was smarting from the pain, a dog appeared and trotted toward us. The mutt approached us, gently wagging its tail. Just as I was leaning down to pet its head, Sakurai let out a low growl. Grrr! The dog stopped in its tracks, and after flopping its ears forward, gave us a look like, "Sorry to have bothered you," and trotted back disappointedly from where he came. I gave Sakurai a look. She said, "Keep all buttonskis at bay. That's a hard and fast rule of dating," and smiled sweetly. After heading out of the park, we went to a CD shop. I recommended Sakurai buy Bruce Springsteen's Tunnel of Love, an album I especially liked. The album Sakurai said I should buy was one by a jazz pianist named Horace Parlin called Us Three. I had never listened to jazz before. "My father likes jazz, so I grew up listening to it," explained Sakurai, holding up the CD. "This is really cool." We wandered around Ginza, stopped at a diner we spotted along the way, and had dinner there. Then we enjoyed an after-dinner stroll to Kachidoki Bridge. We smelled the sea air. "Wouldn't it be nice to go to the beach and see the ocean?" said Sakurai. I nodded. "We should go sometime, soon." We said goodbye at Yurakucho Station. Sakurai let out a quick, "See you," and disappeared up the stairs to the train platform. I went up the stairs to the opposite platform with the same disappointed gait of that dog in the park. I stopped at a random spot on the platform and was looking down at nothing when I noticed a shadow above my vision moving frenetically on the opposite platform. I looked up. Sakurai was standing on her tippy toes, hopping almost, and waving at me. The eyes of the passengers on both platforms were trained on me. As I stood there, frozen and unable to respond, I could sense the crowd's irritation. The loudspeakers announced an arriving train, and I could hear people clicking their tongue at me. Fighting back my embarrassment, I raised a hand and waved to her. I felt the relief of the crowd. The train pulled into Sakurai's side of the platform, putting her out of sight. I casually lowered my hand and hastily moved from where I'd been standing. People looked on as if they were watching a grandson taking his first steps. When I got home, I found my mother playing chess with my father in the living room. She'd come home. "Were you on a date?" my mother asked, advancing her queen. "Check." My father said, "I'm in trouble," but he seemed to be in awfully high spirits thanks to my mother's return. "No comment," I answered. "Just don't do anything irresponsible," said my mother. "I know." My father looked up from the chessboard. He was smiling, his eyes sparkling like those of a kid on the first day of summer vacation. "I can't win," he said to me. "There's no way out. She's just too good." I knew he'd been lonely, but this was pathetic. After I completed my daily routine, I listened to Us Three. It was really cool. I listened to it three times all the way through before falling asleep. The next day, Kato, whom I hadn't seen since his birthday party, showed up at my classroom during lunch period. "Hey, lover boy," he said, sitting in the seat next to me.
"Jeez, what happened to your face?" I asked.
Kato's face was darker, like he had a tan. "My father gave me a trip to Guam for my birthday. It was awesome."
"What a blessed life you lead," I said sarcastically.
"So," Kato began, a smirk plastered on his face, "did you do it yet?"
"You asking me to rearrange your nose again?"
Kato put a hand to his nose and snapped into a defensive position. "Come on, give me a break."
"Do you even know who she is?" I asked.
His hand still on his nose, Kato shook his head. "I was curious, so after you two left the party, I asked around, but no one knew who she was.
So you can relax. If no one in my crew knows who she is, that has to mean she's a proper girl. How did you meet up with a cute girl like that anyway?"
"I'm not exactly sure. She's pretty mysterious. She just suddenly appeared and pulled me into her world."
Kato lowered his hand from his nose and said with a straight face,
Maybe she's a snow spirit. Or a crane you once saved coming back to repay the debt in human form, like in the folk tale.
The inside of your head must have dried up from being out in the sun too long.
Hey, I was born this way, Kato said. If you're curious, I can do some digging for you. She's in high school, right? If I know where she goes, I can pretty much find out anything through my connections.
I wavered for a moment and shook my head.
Nah, whoever she is, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're right, Kato said, looking happy for some reason. This all sounds like a lot of fun, like something out of the movies.
So long as it doesn't turn out to be a mystery or a suspense thriller.
The bell chimed the end of lunch period. Kato rose from his seat. As an objective viewer, I'd prefer seeing a horror or occult film. It'd be exciting to see your wiener get lopped off or something.
Kato patted me on the shoulder.
Best of luck.
Calling Sakurai every Monday night became part of my weekly routine. Sometime after the Golden Week holidays, calling Sakurai became a part of my daily routine. We spent most of our days off together. As we continued to see each other, a certain understanding grew between us. We each had to find cool things the other would like. We recommended all kinds of books, CDs, and movies to each other and classified them simply according to whether they were cool or uncool. Sakurai tended to rate most of the things I recommended as cool. Bruce Springsteen, Lou Reed, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, Tom Waits, John Lennon, Eric Clapton, Muddy Waters, Buddy Guy. But Neil Young just wasn't her cup of tea. I asked her why.
He's not a good singer.
I thought most of the things Sakurai recommended to me were cool. Miles Davis, Bill Evans, Oscar Peterson, Cecil Taylor, Dexter Gordon, Milt Jackson, Ella Fitzgerald, Mozart, Richard Strauss, Debussy. But John Coltrane just wasn't my cup of tea. She asked me why.
Too dark.
My recommendation of Bruce Lee's Fist of Fury became one of her favorites. I wound up taking a lot of roundhouse kicks in the leg thanks to that movie. Sakurai's recommendation of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest became one of my favorites. After I told her so, I got stuck having to watch more than my fill of Jack Nicholson films. Sakurai really liked Jack Nicholson. I asked her why.
He's strange and cool.
Sakurai was strange and cool, too. Books were a pretty weak field for me, because I hardly read any novels and only read dense books about anthropology, archaeology, biology, history, and philosophy. It was hard to recommend a book that anyone else would find interesting. The novels I'd read based on Jung Il's recommendation were generally old Japanese novels that Sakurai had already read. Sakurai had been influenced by her book-loving father. She'd read a lot of books. I read all kinds of novels that Sakurai recommended to me. John Irving, Stephen King, and Ray Bradbury became some of my favorite novelists. But I especially liked James M. Cain's The Postman Always Rings Twice and Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye. When I told Sakurai so, she said proudly, "I knew you'd like them." There were also things that we excavated together. Dashiell Hammett, Silito, Jack Finney, Raymond Carver, Chariots of Fire, Purple Noon, The Trouble with Harry, Days of Wine and Roses, The Wild Bunch, Elvis Costello, R.E.M., T-Rex, Donny Hathaway, The Kronos Quartet, Henrik Goretzky, Terence Blanchard, Egon Schiele, Andrew Wyeth, J.M.W. Turner, Roy Lichtenstein. This excavation work was incredibly fun. Our method was simple. Walk into a bookstore or CD shop or video rental store together and go with our gut instinct. That was it. We looked at the book cover or CD jacket or video cover art and chose whatever spoke to us. but our gut instinct turned out to be your basic 300 hitter. There were strikeouts and lots of easy grounders and flyouts, not to mention lots of time and money wasted. The excavation work was fun anyway. On the first Sunday of June, we were in a fast food chain in Ginza when Sakurai asked out of the blue, "Do you want to come back to my house now?" I didn't know how to answer, so Sakurai added, "We have a media room because of my father's many hobbies. We can listen to music and watch movies together there. That way we can talk about what we thought right after."
"Won't your father mind if you bring a guy home?"
"My family is completely cool about stuff like that," said Sakurai, giving me a tight-lipped smile. "My older sister is always bringing home her boyfriends for dinner." Sakurai was looking at me with serious eyes.
I nodded. "Yeah, okay."
Sakurai let out a sigh of relief. "I didn't know what I'd do if you said no." Sakurai's house was in an upscale residential area in Setagaya. Sakurai's father had a tuft of hair parted in the middle. He was wearing an expensive-looking denim shirt and nicely faded jeans. He looked at his daughter's male friend without batting an eye, smiled gracefully, and said, "Welcome." I was shown into the living room and took a seat on the cushy sofa. The mother, with the same look of refinement as Sakurai, appeared with a tray. As she set cups of tea on the table, she said, "Welcome. Please look after our daughter," and excused herself from the living room.
"Where do you go to school, Sugihara-kun?" the father asked.
I told him the name of my high school, to which he said, "Hmm," and said, "It must be a very good school." I told him truthfully,
"Not at all."
Sakurai, sitting next to her father, let out a chuckle, a tiny one, so as not to be too noticeable. I guess Sakurai's father loved to talk. For a while, he talked my ear off about a lot of different things. He was a graduate of Tokyo University. He was involved in the student protest movement in the late 60s. He was a salaryman at a famous trading company. He really loved jazz. He called black people African Americans. He called Indians Native Americans. He hated Japan.
"Do you like this country, Sugihara-kun?" he asked, as soon as Sakurai left to use the bathroom.
I didn't know how to answer, and he continued,
"I have flown around the world on business, and I've never seen a more unprincipled country than this one. It's enough to make me ashamed to call myself Japanese overseas. To express my active rejection of the Japanese government, I refuse to participate in elections. If I have time to go vote, I'd rather spend that time with my family. Doing so will ultimately make Japan..."
"Are you," I cut in, "familiar with the meaning of the name Japan?" The father, with a deflated look, gave some thought to my question and answered,
"It's the land of the rising, isn't it?"
"That's one theory, but apparently there are lots of others. The theory that Hinomoto, or the sun's origin, which is a common epithet for Yamato, eventually turned into the country's name is one example. Scholars are still debating over it. One book that I read recently said that Japan is a rare country whose citizens grow up knowing nothing about how their country's name was derived because it's completely overlooked in history education." I was babbling. Sakurai's father stared at me with a look that seemed to ask, "So?" Suddenly, I was hit with a feeling of futility.
What am I doing here?
And then the answer came into view. Sakurai returned from the bathroom and, without sitting down again, told her father, "I think it's time to give Sugihara some space." As we left and headed for the media room, Sakurai asked in a low voice,
"Too annoying?"
Shaking my head, I told her, "Not at all." It was the first lie I ever told her. The media room was in the basement, a 10-tatami room with finely grained wood flooring. It was equipped with a very expensive-looking stereo and speakers, and a projector and a giant screen. Hundreds of CDs, LPs, and DVDs lined the built-in shelves along the walls.
Taking up the center of the room was the same sofa as the one in the living room. Sakurai put Mozart's Symphony No. 25 in the CD cradle and sat on the sofa. She saw me staring at the words on the spine of the CD case and said, "Come over here," while patting the cushion next to her. I sat down on the sofa, leaving a small space between us. Sakurai picked up the remote and turned on the CD player. The symphony blared from the speakers. After some time passed, Sakurai tapped me on the shoulder. Her mouth was opening and closing, but I couldn't hear her. At first, I thought I couldn't hear because of the deafening music, but quickly realized that she wasn't making a sound on purpose. Her mouth kept repeating the same movements. Watching her lips go from one shape to the next, I could hear the three words in my head. "I like you." I reached out and put my hand on the nape of her neck. Her lips stopped moving. I tensed my hand behind her neck and pulled her toward me. We must have kissed for about 10 minutes. We didn't unlock lips once until the symphony's first movement ended. When we came out of the media room, dinner was waiting upstairs. Before I could protest, I was seated at the table. Sakurai's older sister was there, too. She was giving me a serious once-over, ignoring all pretense of restraint. Itadakimasu. Let's eat. Dinner began. It occurred to me that this was my first time eating with a Japanese family. After this realization, I became so nervous that the chopsticks felt a little heavy in my hand. Sakurai, maybe thinking I was nervous for a different reason, brought up all sorts of cheerful topics to try to ease the tension and filled the dinner table with laughter. Sakurai's parents and older sister were really friendly people. I laughed a lot at their stories and occasionally joined in the conversation. Before I knew it, I even found my appetite. Noticing Sakurai's father filling his glass a couple of times with iced tea, I asked, "Do you not drink?" "None of us here can drink alcohol," Sakurai answered instead. "Even a sip will knock us out cold." "Do you drink much, Sugihara-kun?" Sakurai's sister asked, smiling meaningfully. "I'm still underage," I answered with a serious face, which prompted a short laugh. Apparently, people with innately low alcohol tolerance exist only in the Mongoloid race. Everyone in the family nodded with mild interest. I was going to explain why, but decided against it. "What's the difference between someone who can drink and someone who can't?" Sakurai asked. "When you consume alcohol, a toxic compound called acetaldehyde is created and makes you feel drunk. Someone with a high tolerance doesn't get drunk because the ALDH2 enzymes in their body work to break down the acetaldehyde. But not in someone with low tolerance. Their ALDH2 enzymes don't." After listening to my explanation, Sakurai's father nodded his satisfaction and said, "Like I said, you must go to a very good high school." Sakurai and her older sister chuckled quietly to themselves. I guess Sakurai had talked to her sister about me. When we were ready to leave the house, Sakurai's father saw us off at the door and said, "You're welcome anytime." Sakurai seemed happy the whole time we walked back to the train station. When we stopped at the ticket barrier to say goodbye, she said, "I think my father liked you." I nodded vaguely. Looking down a bit, she said, "My father isn't exactly stylish, but he's not a bad guy. He's really sweet and understanding." I playfully feigned a punch, just touching Sakurai's left cheek. She raised her head and looked at me. "I'm really glad if your father liked me," I said.
"Really?"
I gave her a firm nod. Sakurai let out a relieved sigh and smiled bashfully. "So I noticed your family didn't call you by your name," Sakurai said cheerfully.
"That's because I warned them not to."
"It'd be nice to know eventually," I said.
"Mysterious, isn't it?"
Sakurai narrowed her eyes into that challenging look of hers.
"I guess I'll tell you, eventually."
Ever since that first visit to Sakurai's house, most of our dates took place there. Sakurai and I spent a lot of time in the media room. Once, we spent the whole day watching all three movies in the Godfather series. The Godfather trilogy meant a lot to me. In the opening of The Godfather Part 2, the scene with young Vito Corleone arriving on Ellis Island and looking at the Statue of Liberty has got to be the most beautiful scene I have ever seen in movies. I'd become convinced that as long as there are immigrants and refugees in this world, the Godfather movies will live on. When I stressed this to Sakurai, she said, smiling, "I don't know if I understand completely, but I know that you really love The Godfather, Sugihara." Another time, we listened to a bunch of Miles Davis recordings. Sakurai lectured me about the importance of